former president laid the groundwork for these false claims well in advance of the election, as early as April 2020.
Today, highlights from the second public hearing of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. The main witnesses were from former President Trump's inner circle, including former Attorney General William Barr, Trump's lawyers, and his former campaign manager, Bill Stepien. The committee also laid out how Trump used lies about election fraud to raise $250 million from his supporters for an election defense fund that didn't exist. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection held its second public hearing Monday. Video testimony was aired of numerous Trump White House insiders saying there was no basis to Donald Trump's claims the election was stolen. Former Attorney General William Barr said Trump was, quote, detached from reality for refusing to accept his election loss. The committee also revealed Trump heavily relied on far-fetched claims by his lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani, who was reportedly drunk on election night when he pushed Trump to falsely claim victory. The House panel also examined how Trump's campaign raked in over $250 million in donations from his supporters after the election for an election defense fund that did not exist. This is committee member, Congressmember Zoe Lofgren.
Throughout the committee's investigation, we found evidence that the Trump campaign and its surrogates misled donors as to where their funds would go and what they would be used for. So not only was there the big lie, there was the big ripoff.
We'll spend the rest of the show after headlines on the January 6th hearing, and Democracy Now! Is live streaming all these hearings live at democracynow.org. The next one is Wednesday morning at 10 Eastern. It's primary day in Maine, Nevada, North Dakota, and South Carolina. In Nevada, Republican voters will be deciding who will challenge Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto in November, in a race that could decide who controls the Senate. The Republican Senate race pits former Nevada Attorney General Adam Laxalt against retired Army Captain Sam Brown. Laxalt's a close ally of Donald Trump, who supported Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election. A number of other Republicans who supported Trump's coup attempt are also on the ballot today. The lives of 338,000 people who died of COVID-19 could have been saved if the United States had a universal health care system. That's the finding of a new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, USA. The study also estimates a universal health care system would have saved the United States $459 billion in health care costs in the year 2020. The study's lead author, Allison Galvani of the Yale School of Public Health, told Scientific American, quote, "Medicare for all would be both an economic stimulus and life-saving transformation of our healthcare system. It'll cost people far less than the status quo," she said. In other health news, a new study funded by the National Institutes of Health has concluded ivermectin is not effective at treating COVID-19. The study was conducted by researchers at Duke and Vanderbilt universities. The United Kingdom's expected to begin flying asylum seekers to Rwanda today as part of a new immigration policy widely decried by religious leaders and human rights groups. The UK plans to send asylum seekers to Rwanda who have crossed the English Channel into Britain, regardless of where they came from originally. Leaders in the Church of England have condemned what they describe as a, quote, immoral policy that shames Britain. On Monday, Filippo Grandi, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, also criticized the plan.
The precedent that this creates is catastrophic for a concept that needs to be shared, like asylum. We believe that this is all wrong. This is all wrong, this deal, for so many different reasons. And I can enumerate a few.
In eastern Ukraine, Russian forces have destroyed the last bridge connecting Severodonetsk to other areas under Ukrainian control as heavy fighting continues in the city. Ukraine's calling on Western nations to provide far more in heavy arms. On Monday, Ukraine requested 300 rocket launchers, 500 tanks and 1,000 howitzers. This comes as Russia's begun issuing passports in some areas it's occupying in eastern Ukraine as Russia attempts to solidify its rule in the region. Meanwhile, Russia's accusing Ukraine of firing NATO-supplied artillery on a market in a Russia-controlled area of Donetsk, killing three people, including a child. Authorities in India have demolished the homes of several Muslim activists who organized protests last week, triggered by recent anti-Islamic comments made by two members of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP party. The demolitions took place in the northern Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. Police also shot dead two teenage Muslim protesters. Hundreds of Muslims have been arrested. The Indian journalist Rana Ayub tweeted on Monday, quote, "The Modi government's never sent a more chilling message to its Muslim minorities. Speak up, protest, and you will be jailed, booked for terrorism, your houses demolished, shot in public with no semblance of law and judiciary," she said. A number of Muslim countries have also lodged protests over India's treatment of its Muslim population and recent statements by Hindu officials insulting the Prophet Muhammad. Iran suspects Israel is responsible for poisoning two Iranian scientists who recently died within days of each other in separate cities after apparent food poisoning. The New York Times reports one of the scientists worked at an Iranian military research center. The other was a geologist who, according to some press accounts, may have worked at Iran's Natanz nuclear facility. Israel is also believed to be behind last month's drone attack on an Iranian military site that killed a young Iranian engineer who worked for Iran's Ministry of Defense. Over 100 million people are under heat advisories in the United States as an early season heat wave continues to break records from the Southwest to the Gulf Coast to the Great Lakes. Over the weekend, temperatures in Phoenix, Arizona reached 114 degrees Fahrenheit and 109 degrees in Las Vegas, Nevada. In Houston, local officials warned residents to stay inside.
When you have extreme heat, then everyone is a danger. When you suffer heat exhaustion, or heat stroke, then your vital organs, your brain suffers damages, and you could die.
This comes as wildfires have forced hundreds of people to evacuate their homes in California, New Mexico, and Arizona. According to the National Interagency Fire Center, firefighters are battling more than three dozen uncontained fires. In Montana, record flooding has forced the closing of all five entrances to Yellowstone National Park. Roads and bridges in the area have been washed away. Some visitors are stranded in the park following unprecedented rainfall. Flood levels on the Yellowstone River are now beyond record levels. In some areas, the river is 2 feet higher than previous records. Scientists have long warned the climate emergency will lead to an increase in the number and severity of heat waves, wildfires, and storms. In related news, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate Malala Yousafzai joined with youth climate activists Greta Thunberg and Vanessa Nakate on Friday in a protest outside the Swedish parliament. Yousafzai talked about how the climate emergency is impacting girls across the globe.
Due to climate-related events, millions of girls lose their access to schools. Events like droughts and floods impact schools directly. Displacements are caused due to some of these events. And because of that, girls are impacted the most. They're the first ones to drop out of schools and then the last ones to return as well.
In Ohio, Republican Governor Mike DeWine has signed a bill to make it easier for teachers and staff to carry guns in school. Under the new law, teachers and staff will need just 24 hours of training, down from 700 hours. Teacher unions and the Fraternal Order of Police of Ohio have opposed the new law. The U.S. Supreme Court issued two rulings on Monday, which will make it much harder for people in immigration custody to challenge their detention. In one case, the court ruled non-citizens who've been held for more than 6 months in immigration custody are not entitled to bond hearings. Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote the majority opinion. In a second related case, the court ruled jailed immigrants cannot come together to file class action lawsuits to demand periodic bond hearings. But in this case, Sotomayor wrote a partial dissent, noting, quote, today's holding risks depriving many vulnerable non-citizens of any meaningful opportunity to protect their rights. Police officers in Idaho have reportedly received death threats after arresting 31 members of the white supremacist organization known as the Patriot Front, who are accused of plotting to start a riot at a gay pride event in the city of Coeur d'Alene. The white supremacists were found packed into the back of a U-Haul truck armed with riot gear, including a smoke grenade and shields. On Monday, the Patriot Front members were released on bail, which was set at $300 per person. A group of more than 300 doctors from around the world are calling on UK Home Secretary Priti Patel to block the extradition of Julian Assange. In a letter to Patel, the group known as Doctors for Assange say the WikiLeaks founder suffered a mini-stroke last October and that his overall health is continuing to deteriorate in prison. The doctors write, quote, the extradition of a person with such compromised health, moreover, is medically and ethically unacceptable, they said. Patel is expected to rule on Assange extradition by Friday. And there are conflicting reports out of Brazil about the search for the missing British journalist Dom Phillips and the Brazilian indigenous expert Bruno Araújo Pereira. The pair went missing over a week ago in one of Brazil's most remote areas of the Amazon. On Monday, the family of Phillips said they were notified by the Brazilian embassy in London that two bodies tied to a tree were found during the search operation. However, the federal police in Brazil and indigenous activists aiding the search have said no bodies have been found. The search is focused on a remote area where authorities found personal items belonging to the two men on Saturday. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Monday, the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6 attack on the United States Capitol held its second public hearing, with two more scheduled this week, Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern and Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Democracy Now! Is bringing you the hearings live at democracynow.org. The Washington Post reports there will likely be eight hearings this month, with a possible final hearing in September just ahead of November's midterm elections. Monday's hearing was briefly delayed when one of the witnesses, former Trump campaign manager Bill Stepien, pulled out of testifying live when his wife went into labor. In addition to becoming a father, Stepien is also currently serving as an advisor to the Trump-endorsed congressional candidate running against the committee's Republican vice chair, Liz Cheney, in Wyoming. Video testimony was aired Monday of numerous Trump White House insiders saying there was no basis to Donald Trump's claims the election was stolen. The committee also laid out how Trump used lies about election fraud to raise $250 million from his supporters for an election defense fund that did not exist. This is part of committee Vice Chair Liz Cheney's opening remarks.
First, you will hear firsthand testimony that the president's campaign advisors urged him to await the counting of votes and not to declare victory on election night. The president understood even before the election that many more Biden voters had voted by mail because President Trump ignored the advice of his campaign experts and told his supporters only to vote in person. Donald Trump knew before the election that the counting of those mail-in ballots in several states would not begin until late in the day and would not be complete for multiple days. This was expected, reported, and widely known. You will also hear testimony that President Trump rejected the advice of his campaign experts on election night and instead followed the course recommended by an apparently inebriated Rudy Giuliani to just claim he won and insist that the vote counting stop, to falsely claim everything was fraudulent. He falsely told the American people that the election was not legitimate. In his words, quote, a major fraud. Millions of Americans believed him. Second, pay attention to what Donald Trump and his legal team said repeatedly about Dominion voting machines. Far-flung conspiracies with a deceased Venezuelan communist allegedly pulling the strings. This was, quote, complete nonsense, as Bill Barr said. President Trump's own campaign advisors, his Department of Justice, and his cybersecurity experts all told him the same thing. Here, for example, is White House lawyer Eric Hirschman. His view was shared by many of the Trump team whom we interviewed.
I thought the Dominion stuff was... I never saw any evidence whatsoever to sustain those allegations.
And third, as Mike Pence's staff started to get a sense for what Donald Trump had planned for January 6th, they called the campaign experts to give them a briefing on election fraud and all the other election claims. On January 2nd, the general counsel of the Trump campaign, Matthew Morgan, this is the campaign's chief lawyer, summarized what the campaign had concluded weeks earlier, that none of the arguments about fraud or anything else could actually change the outcome of the election.
Generally discussed on that topic was whether the fraud, maladministration, abuse, or irregularities, if aggregated and read most favorably to the campaign, would that be outcome determinative? And I think everyone's assessment in the room, at least amongst the staff, Mark Short, myself, and Greg Jacob, was that it was not sufficient to be outcome determinative.
As is obvious, this was before the attack on the Capitol. The Trump campaign legal team knew there was no legitimate argument, fraud, irregularities, or anything to overturn the election. And yet President Trump went ahead with his plans for January 6th anyway.
That's January 6th committee vice chair, Republican Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney. During Monday's hearing, the committee featured video testimony from the depositions of some of former President Trump's top campaign staff, including senior advisor Jason Miller, and Trump's own daughter, Ivanka Trump, who was his senior advisor, who all said Trump ignored them on election night in November 2020 when they argued against declaring victory. They described how Trump instead turned to his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, who they said was drunk when he urged Trump to claim he'd won and say the election was being stolen. This is former Trump campaign manager Bill Stepien in deposition testimony.
Do you remember Rudy Giuliani being at the White House on election night and into the early hours the next morning?
I do.
What do you remember about when he came?
I had heard that he was upstairs, you know, in that aforementioned reception area, and he was looking to talk to the president, and it was suggested instead that he come talk to several of us down off the map room.
You said that you had heard that Mr. Giuliani wanted to talk to the president, and then he was directed your way. Did you end up talking to Mr. Giuliani when he was directed your way?
I did.
What was that conversation?
A lot of conversations were directed my way. a few of us, myself, Jason Miller, Justin Clark, and Mark Meadows, gathered in a room off the map room to listen to whatever Rudy presumably wanted to say to the president.
Was there anyone in that conversation who, in your observation, had too much to drink?
Mayor Giuliani.
Tell me more about that. What was your observation about his potential intoxication during that discussion about what the president should say when he's addressed the nation on election night?
And the mayor was definitely intoxicated, but I do not know that his level of intoxication when he spoke with the president, for example.
Were you part of any discussions with the people I mentioned, Mr. Stepien, Mr. Meadows, or anyone else, about whether the president should make any sort of speech on election night?
I spoke to the president. They may have been present, but president spoke to the president several times that night.
There were suggestions by, I believe it was Mayor Giuliani, to go and declare victory and say that we'd won it outright.
It was far too early to be making any calls like that. ballots were still being counted. Ballots were still going to be counted for days. And it was far too early to be making any proclamation like that.
I remember saying that, to the best of my memory, I was saying that we should not go and declare victory until we had a better sense of the numbers.
Okay. Can you be more specific about that conversation, in particular what Mayor Giuliani said, your response, and then anybody else in the room's response?
I think effectively Mayor Giuliani was saying, we want it. They're stealing it from us. Where'd all the votes come from? We need to go say that we won. And essentially, to anyone who didn't agree with that position was being weak.
That's Jason Miller.
What was your view at the time as to what he should or shouldn't say?
I don't know that I had a firm view as to what he should say in that circumstance. The results were still being counted. It was becoming clear that the race would not be called on election night.
That
was Ivanka Trump. This bill stepped
in. My recommendation was to say that votes were still being counted. It's too early to tell, too early to call the race. But, you know, we proud of the race we ran, and we, you know, think we're in good position, and we'll have more to say about this, you know, the next day, whenever we had something to say.
And did anybody who was a part of that conversation disagree with your message?
Yes.
Who is that?
The president disagreed with that. I don't recall the particular words. He thought I was wrong. He told me so. And, you know, that they were going to, you know, go in a different direction.
That last voice, former Trump campaign manager Bill Stepien. When we come back, other former members of President Trump's inner circle, including former Attorney General William Barr. The January 6th committee also laid out how Trump lied about election fraud to raise $250 million from his supporters for an election defense fund that did not exist. Stay with us.
Sensations make me feel the pleasures of a normal man. These sensations bear the insults, leave them for another day. I've got the spirit, lose the feeling, take the shock away.
Disorder by Joy Division. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're bringing you highlights from Monday's hearing of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, the second of eight hearings scheduled for this month. One of the key witnesses who testified live was former Fox News political editor Chris Steirwalt, who led the Fox News decision to become the first network to call Arizona for Joe Biden on election night, November 2020. Fox fired Steirwalt months later. Answering questions from California Congressmember Zoe Lofgren, Steirwalt said Trump's chance of winning was virtually zero. His comments were supported by Trump's former Attorney General, William Barr.
Mr. Steirwalt, I'd like you to explain a term that was thrown around a lot during the election, and that's the so-called red mirage. What does that mean?
So, in the 40 or 50 years, let's say, that Americans have increasingly chosen to vote by mail or early or absentee, Democrats prefer that method of voting more than Republicans do. So basically, in every election, Republicans win election day and Democrats win the early vote. And then you wait and start counting. And it depends on which ones you count first, but usually it's election day votes that get counted first. And you see the Republicans shoot ahead, and then the process of bailing and binding and unbinding all those mail-in votes. And some states, like Pennsylvania, refuse to count the votes first. So you have to wait for all of that to come in. So in every election, certainly a national election, you expect to see the Republican with a lead, but it's not really a lead. When you put together a jigsaw puzzle, it doesn't matter which piece you put in first. It ends up with the same image. So for us, who cares? But that's because no candidate had ever tried to avail themselves of this quirk in the election counting system. We had gone to pains, and I'm proud of the pains we went to make sure that we were informing viewers that this was going to happen, because the Trump campaign and the president had made it clear that they were going to try to exploit this anomaly. And we knew it was going to be bigger, because the percentage of early votes was higher, right? We went from about 45% of the votes being early and absentee to, because of the pandemic, that increased by about 50%. So we knew it would be longer. We knew it would be more. So we wanted to keep telling viewers, hey, look, the number that you see here is sort of irrelevant because it's only a small percentage of these votes.
So this red mirage, that's really what you expected to happen on election night.
Happens every time.
Thank you, Mr. Steierwald. Now, I'd like to play a clip of Attorney General Bill Barr, who also explains what was expected to happen on election night.
Right out of the box on election night, the president claimed that there was major fraud underway. I mean, this happened, as far as I could tell, before there was actually any potential of looking at evidence. And it seemed to be based on the dynamic that that at the end of the evening, a lot of Democratic votes came in, which changed the vote counts in certain states. And that seemed to be the basis for this broad claim that there was major fraud. And I didn't think much of that, because people had been talking for weeks and everyone understood for weeks that that was going to be what happened on election night.
Mr. Stepien obviously could not be with us today, and it's proper for him to be with his wife as they welcome their child. But he also had discussions with the president about the red mirage, that is, that it would be a long night and that early votes would favor him, but that lots more votes would be counted over the course of the night and the days after. So let's play clip one from our interview with Mr. Stepien.
I recounted back to that conversation with him, in which I said, just like I said in 2016, was going to be a long night. I told him in 2020 that, it was going to be a process again, as, you know, the early returns are going to be, you know, positive, and we're going to, you know, be watching the returns of ballots as, you know, they rolled in thereafter.
So is it fair to say you're trying to present what you thought would be a realistic picture of what might happen over the course of that night, being election night?
That night and the days that followed. Yeah, I always told the president the truth, and I think he expected that from me, and I told him it was going to be a process. It was going to be, we're going to have to wait and see how this turned out. So I just like I did in 2016, I did the same thing in 2020.
So let's watch a short clip of President Trump speaking after he received that information from his campaign advisors.
We want all voting to stop. We don't want them to find any ballots at 4 o'clock in the morning and add them to the list.
So when former President Trump said that, it contradicted what his advisors had warned would happen. We all know that mail-in ballots played an important role in the 2020 election. However, President Trump continuously discouraged mail-in voting. Mr. Stepien was so concerned about the president's position on mail-in voting that in the summer of 2020, he met with President Trump along with House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. Let's play clip four.
Meeting that was had, in particular, I invited Kevin McCarthy to join the meeting, he being of like mind on the issue with me, in which we made our case for why we believed mail-in voting, not to be a bad thing for his campaign. But the president's mind was made up, and he understands, how many times to, go to the well on a particular topic.
Yeah, I understand. Tell me a little bit more about the argument that you and Mr. McCarthy made to the president in that meeting as to why it wasn't a bad thing that mail-in voting was available.
Largely two pillars to that argument, both of which I've previously mentioned. One, leaving a good deal to chance, pushing or urging your voters to vote only on Election Day leaves a lot to chance. That's A. And B, also previously mentioned, the fact that the Trump campaign, Republican National Committee, the Republican Party, had an advantage of grassroots workers and volunteers on the ground that would allow, an advantage to enhance return rates of ballots that were mailed. Those were the two pillars of the argument.
I see. And what, if anything, do you recall Representative McCarthy saying during that meeting?
We were echoing the same argument. I mean, his words echoed mine and vice versa on those two topics.
So this is January 6th committee member Zoe Lofgren presenting deposition testimony again from Trump's former campaign manager, Bill Stepien, who you were just listening to. He said he'd contradicted false election victory claims by Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and was part of what he called Team Normal.
Okay. And was it important for you, Mr. Stepien, to sort of pull back just for your own professional reputation? You didn't want to be associated with some of what you were hearing from the Giuliani team and others that sort of stepped in the wake of your departure?
I didn't mind being categorized. There were two groups of we called them kind of my team and Rudy's team. I didn't mind being characterized as being part of Team Normal, as reporters, kind of started to do around that point in time. I said, hours ago early on that, I've been doing this for a long time, 25 years, and I've spanned, political ideologies from Trump to McCain to Bush to Christie, I can work under a lot of circumstances for a lot of varied, candidates and politicians, but situation where, and I think along the way, I've built up a pretty good, I hope, a good reputation for being honest and professional. And I didn't think what was happening was necessarily honest or professional at that point in time. So that led to me stepping away.
So the president did get rid of Team Normal. And I'd like to play a clip showing that the president found the people he needed to perpetuate his claims of fraud.
They saw a big truck bringing in 100,000 ballots in garbage cans, in waste paper baskets, in cardboard boxes, and in shopping baskets. And every single one of them was for Biden, because they were being notified by Smartmatic in Frankfurt that Biden was way behind and they better come up with a lot more ballots, and we can prove every single thing I just said. If you gave me the paper ballots, I could probably turn around each one of these states. I'm absolutely convinced if you let me examine each one of those ballots, I'd pull out enough that were fraudulent, that it would shake the hell out of the country.
It can set and run an algorithm that probably ran all over the country to take a certain percentage of votes from President Trump and flip them to President Biden, which we might never have uncovered had the votes for President Trump not been so overwhelming in so many of these states that it broke the algorithm.
I remember that one of the things Mark said at some point was, you can't show an actual vote was flipped, which I found at the time to be a remarkable assertion, because because you don't have to have the gun to see the body lying on the floor bleeding out with five bullet holes in it was killed by a gun.
What they were proposing, I thought, was nuts. You know, the theory was also completely nuts, right? I mean, it was a combination of Italians, the Germans. I mean, different things have been floating around as to who was involved. I mean, Hugo Chavez and a Venezuelan. She has an affidavit from somebody who says they wrote a software in and something with the Philippines, and just all over the radar.
Did you ever share, Mr. Kushner, your view of Mr. Giuliani? Did you ever share your perspective about him with the president?
I guess yes.
Tell me what you said.
Basically, not the approach I would take if I was you.
Okay. And how did he react? How did President Trump react when you shared that view with him?
We said, you know, I have confidence in Rudy.
I think I had conversations with probably all of our counsel who are signed up to assist on Election Day as they disengaged with the campaign. The general consensus was that the law firms were not comfortable making the arguments that Rudy Giuliani was making publicly. I seem to recall that I had a similar conversation with most all of them.
I made it clear I did not agree with the idea of saying the election was stolen and putting out this stuff, which I told the president was bullshit. And, you know, I didn't want to be a part of it. And that's one of the reasons that went into me deciding to leave when I did.
That last voice is the video recording of the deposition of former Attorney General Bill Barr, who continues in this testimony. He talked about how he became demoralized after the 2020 election when he tried to counter allegations of voting fraud with then-President Trump.
I felt that things continued to deteriorate between the 23rd and the weekend of the 29th. And then on November 29th, he appeared on Maria Bartiromo's show, Sunday Futures, I believe it was, and he said that the department was missing in action.
Well, no, we had glitches where they moved thousands of votes from my account to Biden's account, and these are glitches. So they're not glitches, they're theft, they're fraud, absolute fraud. This election was over, and then they did dumps. They call them dumps, big, massive dumps in Michigan and Pennsylvania and all over. How the FBI and Department of Justice, I don't know, maybe they're involved, but how people are allowed to get away from this with this stuff is unbelievable.
Now, spurred by what he saw, Barr told the Associated Press on December 1st that there was no evidence of election fraud. And immediately after, Attorney General Barr's statement went public, Mr. Trump berated and he nearly fired Barr. But Barr persisted in telling the president that there was no evidence to support the fraud claims.
This got under my skin, but I also felt it was time for me to say something. So I set up a lunch with the AP reporter, Mike Balsamo, and I told him at lunch, I made the statement that to date we have not seen fraud on a scale that could have affected a different outcome in the election. I had a later meeting scheduled at the White House at 3 o'clock with Meadows. This was previously scheduled, so I knew this was going to come up, and I went over there and I told my secretary that I thought I would probably be fired and told not to go home. I mean, not to go back to my office. So I said, you might have to pack up for me. And so when I got over there, I met with the chief of staff. He said the president was angry. He didn't really get into the issue of the fraud. And then I went up to Pat Cipollone's office and we were talking with each other. And word came down that he wanted us both to go to the Oval. And the president was as mad as I've ever seen him, and he was trying to control himself. And the president said, well, this is, you know, killing me. You didn't have to say this. You must have said this because you hate Trump. You hate Trump. And then he raised the big vote dump, as he called it, in Detroit. And that, you know, he said people saw boxes coming into the counting station at all hours of the morning and so forth. And I explained to him that I at that point, I knew the exact number of precincts in Detroit. I think it was 630 something. I said, Mr. President, there are 630 precincts in Detroit. And unlike elsewhere in the state, they centralized the counting process. So they're not counted in each precinct. They're moved to counting stations. And so the normal process would involve boxes coming in at all different hours. So there's nothing. And I said, did anyone point out to you? Did all the people complaining about it point out to you? You actually did better in Detroit than you did last time. I mean, there's no indication of fraud in Detroit. And I told him that the stuff that his people were shoveling out to the public was bullshit. I mean, that the claims of fraud were bullshit. And, you know, he was indignant about that. And I reiterated that they'd wasted a whole month on these claims on the Dominion voting machines, and they were idiotic claims. And I specifically raised the Dominion voting machines, which I found to be among the most disturbing allegations, disturbing in the sense that I saw absolutely zero basis for the allegations, but they were made in such a sensational way that they obviously were influencing a lot of people, members of the public, that there was this systemic corruption in the system and that their votes didn't count and that these machines controlled by somebody else were actually determining it, which was complete nonsense. And it was being laid out there. And I told them that it was crazy stuff and they were wasting their time on that. And it was doing a great, grave disservice to the country.
Okay, so the very next day, the president released a video rehashing some of the very same claims that his chief law enforcement officer had told him were, quote, nonsense.
Here's an example. This is Michigan. At 6:31 in the morning, a vote dump of 149,772 votes came in unexpectedly. We were winning by a lot. That batch was received in horror. We have a company that's very suspect. Its name is Dominion. With the turn of a dial or the change of a chip, you can press a button for Trump and the vote goes to Biden. What kind of a system is this?
Barr again told the president that there was nothing to these claims on December 14th.
When I walked in, sat down, he went off on a monologue saying that there was now definitive evidence involving fraud through the Dominion machines. And a report had been prepared by a very reputable cybersecurity firm, which he identified as Allied Security Operations Group, and he held up the report, and he had then he asked that a copy of it be made for me. And while a copy was being made, he said, you know, this is absolute proof that the Dominion machines were rigged. The report means that I'm going to have a second term. And then he gave me a copy of the report, and as he talked more and more about it, I sat there flipping through the report and looking through it. And to be frank, it looked very amateurish to me. Didn't have the credentials of the people involved, but I didn't see any real qualifications. And the statements were made very conclusory, like, you know, these machines were designed to, you know, engage in fraud or something to that effect, but I didn't see any supporting information for it. And I was somewhat demoralized because I thought, boy, if he really believes this stuff, he has, you know, lost contact he's become detached from reality if he really believes this stuff. On the other hand, you know, when I went into this and would, you know, tell him how crazy some of these allegations were, there was never an indication of interest in what the actual facts were. My opinion then and my opinion now is that the election was not stolen by fraud. And I haven't seen anything since the election that changes my mind on that.
Former Attorney General William Barr, that deposition testimony was played in the second public hearing of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. Back with more in 30 seconds.
People moving out, people moving in. Why? Because of the color of the skin. Run, 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 but you sure can't hide. And I bought a tooth for a tooth. Vote for me and I'll set you free. Rap on, brother, rap on. Well, the only person talking about love and brother is the preacher.
Ball of confusion by the Temptations. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're bringing you highlights from the second public hearing of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. This is live testimony, though, from Al Schmidt, the sole Republican on the Philadelphia County Board of Elections in Pennsylvania, a key battleground state in the 2020 election. He describes how he found no evidence of voter fraud in 2020 and said he and his family received death threats after President Trump lashed out at him on Twitter for not halting the vote count due to false claims of fraud.
Not only was there not evidence of 8,000 dead voters voting in Pennsylvania, there wasn't evidence of eight. We took seriously every case that was referred to us, no matter how fantastical, no matter how absurd, and took every one of those seriously, including these.
As it turns out, even Mr. Trump's campaign lawyers knew that the dead voter claims weren't valid.
I guess the crooks in Philadelphia are disappointed in this. They only submitted 8,021 ballots from dead people, mail-in ballots for dead people. Probably easier for dead people to submit mail-in ballots than it is to vote in person.
Rudy was, at this stage of his life, in the same ability to manage things at this level or not. And obviously, I think Bernie Kerik publicly said it. They never proved the allegations that they were making and they were trying to develop.
Mr. Schmidt, on November 11th, 2020, President Trump tweeted about you, saying, and here's a quote, "A guy named Al Schmidt, a Philadelphia commissioner and so-called Republican or rhino, is being used big time by the fake news media to explain how honest things were with respect to the election in Philadelphia. He refuses to look at a mountain of corruption dishonesty. We win." As a result of that tweet and the CNN interview you gave where you stated the dead voter claims in Pennsylvania were false, you and your staff were subjected to disturbing threats. Can you tell us about that?
The threats prior to that tweet, and on some level it feels almost silly to talk about a tweet, but we can really see the impact that they have, because prior to that, the threats were pretty general in nature. Corrupt election officials in Philadelphia are going to get what's coming to them. You're what the Second Amendment is for. You're walking into the lion's den, all sorts of things like that. After the president tweeted at me by name, calling me out the way that he did, the threats became much more specific, much more graphic, and included not just me by name, but included members of my family by name, their ages, our address, pictures of our home, just every bit of detail that you could imagine. That was what changed with that tweet.
That's Al Schmidt, the sole Republican on the Philadelphia County Board of Elections in Pennsylvania, testifying live on Monday. The January 6th hearing ended with closing statements from committee vice chair, Republican Liz Cheney, and Democrat Zoe Lofgren, describing how the Trump administration raised over $250 million off his supporters on the false claim the 2020 election results were fraudulent.
Now that we understand the litigation efforts by President Trump and his allies, I'd like to present additional actions taken by the Trump campaign during this time. President Trump continued to push the stolen election narrative, even though he and his allies knew that their litigation efforts, making the same claim, had failed. It's worth pointing out that litigation generally does not continue past the safe harbor date of December 14th. But the fact that this litigation went on, well, that decision makes more sense when you consider the Trump campaign's fundraising tactics. Because if the litigation had stopped on December 14th, there would have been no fight to defend the election and no clear path to continue to raise millions of dollars. Mr. Chairman, at this time, I'd ask for unanimous consent to include in the record a video presentation describing how President Trump used the lies he told to raise millions of dollars from the American people. These fundraising schemes were also part of the effort to disseminate the false claims of election fraud.
Without objection, so
my name is Amanda Wick, and I'm senior investigative counsel with the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. Between Election Day and January 6th, the Trump campaign sent millions of fundraising emails to Trump supporters, sometimes as many as 25 a day. The emails claimed the, quote, left-wing mob was undermining the election, implored supporters to, quote, step up to protect the integrity of the election, and encouraged them to, quote, fight back. But as the Select Committee has demonstrated, the Trump campaign knew these claims of voter fraud were false, yet they continued to barrage small-dollar donors with emails, encouraging them to donate to something called the Official Election Defense Fund. The Select Committee discovered no such fund existed.
I don't believe there is actually a fund called the Election Defense Fund.
Is it fair to say the Election Defense Fund was another, as I think we've called it, a marketing tactic?
Yes.
And tell us about these funds as marketing tactics.
Just the topic matter, where money could potentially go to be, how money could potentially be used.
The claims that the election was stolen were so successful, President Trump and his allies raised $250 million, nearly $100 million in the first week after the election. On November 9th, 2020, President Trump created a separate entity called the Save America PAC. Most of the money raised went to this newly created PAC, not to election-related litigation. The Select Committee discovered that the Save America PAC made millions of dollars of contributions to pro-Trump organizations, including $1 million to Trump Chief of Staff Mark Meadows' charitable foundation, $1 million to the America First Policy Institute, a conservative organization which employs several former Trump administration officials, $204,857 to the Trump Hotel Collection, and over $5 million to Event Strategies, Inc., the company that ran President Trump's January 6th rally on the Ellipse.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing.
The evidence developed by the Select Committee highlights how the Trump campaign aggressively pushed false election claims to fundraise, telling supporters it would be used to fight voter fraud that did not exist. The emails continued through January 6th, even as President Trump spoke on the Ellipse. 30 minutes after the last fundraising email was sent, the Capitol was breached.
USA! 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 Every American is entitled and encouraged to participate in our electoral process. Political fundraising is part of that. Small dollar donors use scarce disposable income to support candidates and causes of their choosing, to make their voices heard. And those donors deserve the truth about what those funds will be used for. Throughout the committee's investigation, we found evidence that the Trump campaign and its surrogates misled donors as to where their funds would go and what they would be used for. So not only was there the big lie, there was the big ripoff. Donors deserve to know where their funds are really going. They deserve better than what President Trump and his team did. Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Without objection, the chair recognizes the gentlewoman from Wyoming, Ms. Cheney, for a closing statement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I would like to thank all of our witnesses today. And I'd also like to, in particular, wish Mr. Stepien and his family all the best on the arrival of a new baby. Today's hearing, Mr. Chairman, was very narrowly focused. And in the coming days, you will see the committee move on to President Trump's broader planning for January 6th, including his plan to corrupt the Department of Justice and his detailed planning with lawyer John Eastman to pressure the vice president, state legislatures, state officials, and others to overturn the election. Let me leave you today with one clip to preview what you will see in one of our hearings to come. This is the testimony of White House lawyer Eric Hirschman. John Eastman called Mr. Hirschman the day after January 6th, and here is how that conversation went.
I said to him, "Are you out of your effing mind?" Right? I said, I only want to hear two words coming out of your mouth from now on: orderly transition.
That's former White House lawyer Eric Hirschman. We'll be live streaming all the January 6 hearings at democracynow.org. You can tune in on Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern and then on Thursday at 1 p.m. Then we will bring you highlights on Thursday and Friday of those hearings on Democracy Now! On Monday, we'll be airing a Juneteenth special. We'll talk to Clint Smith on the origins of Juneteenth and his book, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. And we'll also speak with MIT professor Craig Stephen Wilder, author of Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. That does it for our show. To see transcripts, audio, and video podcasts, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maritia Sena, Tammy Warrenoff, Camille Baker, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Conlon, Juan Carlos Davila. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Teaching the youth about roots and culture, and tell the masses them to remember Jah. That's all I need when I am. CKUT is a messenger. Teaching the youth about roots and culture, and tell the masses them to remember Jah. That's all I need when I am. 90.3 FM. It's CKUT, the cultural radio station. Radio McGill. Blessed love, the messenger. Take it away.
CKUT 90.3 FM is proud to rebroadcast the following program entirely in the Mohawk language. The Mohawk, or Ganyatkahaga, are the original people of the unceded traditional territory known as Montreal, or Jojaake. The Ganyatkahaga, or people of the Flint, have two communities close by, and they are working hard at revitalizing their language. This program is part of those efforts, and it originally aired in Ganasadage on RKR Reviving Ganasadage Radio. And now, listen to Jojaake's indigenous language on CKUT 90.3.